Mr. Woody, how are you?
Good. How about you, sir?
Oh, doing great, man. I'm so happy today.
I am too. I'm in a good mood.
Me too. You know why?
Why?
We get to talk to some Microsoft people.
Yeah.
Remember a few weeks ago we talked to Mr. Joe Stump over at Dig.com?
Yeah, that was a good talk. That was very good talk about scaling on the Linux side and PHP and Apache and stuff. So I'm excited about today too.
Yeah, that was a good show. And today, I think what we're going to talk about today, or at least what I like to talk about today, is flipping that around and talking about it from a Microsoft perspective. And so what we did, folks out there listening, is we went out and we found some guys that are doing some large-scale websites at Microsoft. And they're actually in charge of what's called MSCom, and I'm sure they'll tell us all about it. So without further ado, let's welcome Brad and Jim to the show. Guys, how are you?
Doing real good, thanks.
Hello, how you doing?
Thanks for being on the show, guys. Appreciate it.
Yeah, no problem. Our pleasure.
Brad, what's your role there? What do you do? And just kind of give us a little bit of that, then we'll go to Jim.
Well, I'm the group operations manager for the systems engineers and the database administrators for Microsoft.com. So when you come to Microsoft.com, when you're visiting, the engineers that are running the site, that's my team. My team actually runs all of the physical infrastructure that runs Microsoft.com. I'll let Jim explain what he does.
My name's Jim Dobbin, and I run the MSCom debug team. We're kind of the technical team for product adoption and as far as escalating any site availability or performance issues, we basically debug those issues and work with the different product groups and product teams to get the fixes out there.
Cool. So MSCom must be just a monster site. What's your average daily hits on, let's just take Microsoft.com for instance, just get people a scale idea.
Right. So in terms of the homepage, we are right now, you're talking about 15,000 requests per second, over 35,000 concurrent connections. We as measured externally, are in the top five, top 10 for sure, of worldwide reach at 287 million unique users per month. And in the U.S., we have a reach of about 54 million unique users per month.
When you say that you have 15,000 requests a second, now, are all of those numbers just for Microsoft.com, or is that star.microsoft.com?
For just the homepage, so just Microsoft.com.
Who does things like, you know, technet.microsoft.com, msdn.microsoft.com, and all the other stuff?
Yeah, that's a great question. So really, our operations team is separated up into a number of groups. So when it comes to the homepage, my team runs that, and many of the Microsoft.com properties that hang off of that. And then TechNet, MSDN, we have another operations team within our org that focuses on running those servers. They have those metrics, measurements for, how many users they have, and their performance is completely separate. We also run the Windows Update systems as well. So we don't even count when we're talking about unique users and the numbers that I've talked about for the homepage. If you threw in the number of Windows machines globally that are checking in to see if they need, updates, that are scanning themselves for anything from Windows Update, our total number of hits back to the servers that the Microsoft.com operations team run actually goes up dramatically.
So, guys, sounds like you guys push a lot of data around, but how many data centers do you guys have, like maybe across the U.S. and across the world? And what type of bandwidth are you guys using up across all those data centers?
Well, so currently we have servers deployed in 7 data centers globally. We're utilizing primarily data centers out of the United States, and then we have pushed some applications overseas that require the origin servers to be closer to the customers. But for example, in terms of talking about Microsoft.com specifically, it's actually run out of two data centers in the United States. When you throw in Microsoft Update into the mix, that's run out of four different data centers and in the United States again. And we're looking at, as far as bandwidth that we're pushing out of our facilities, it's around 50 to 500 plus gigabits per second. And so the 500 plus is definitely a high watermark. And so in order to be able to sustain that type of traffic, we also utilize a number of content delivery networks where we cache out files. So we partner with Akamai, Level 3, and Limelight, so that some of these files that we push out, we utilize through them, so that we're the origin, but they're actually serving up the bits to consumers that will improve the end-user experience by pushing the content closer to them.
So, Brad, how does that work with a content delivery network? Can you kind of break that down for us a little bit and give us sort of a layman terms of about how it works and what kind of value that it provides for you guys in terms of scaling?
Sure. So for specific sites, we could set up the type of content that we want to deliver directly from origin and the type of content that we want to deliver cached. And so for static files on the page, anything that's not dynamic, we can, through our publishing systems, internally push it out to our Microsoft.com, web servers or web clusters, and then those files get cached out to a content delivery network. So let's say in this example for Akamai. And so what will happen is when a user is coming to Microsoft.com, they're going through the CDN, picks it up, and will actually serve the static content directly to them. So static content like CSS files, JPEGs and GIFs and so forth. So if you were someplace very far away from one of our United States data centers, you still may have a good end user experience getting static content closer to you.
Okay, so it's basically breaking up the data and then shoving it out to where when somebody clicks on something, it's what we call in like a network, there's less hops basically between their computer and when they get the content.
Exactly. It's just caching. So we're pushing files out, globally onto partner servers so that you don't have to come all the way back. In this case, if we were saying we had a data center here in Washington State, you don't have to come all the way back here to get the files from us. You'll get the same files from cached out and on the internet.
So do you guys use those all the time or just at select times when large updates are coming out, like SPs and a lot of updates like for Vista, or do you push those out and use them routinely?
So the question is in terms of downloads now instead of just content on a website?
Yeah, I mean, maybe both. I mean, do you guys use your partners for content updates or is it mainly for the Windows updates?
Absolutely, we use it for content updates. So we utilize the content delivery networks, our partnerships, for downloads heavily, in the fact that if you're coming to get a large download, we will push those downloads out onto our partner servers as well, again to improve the end user experience. So yes, we do.
Well, guys, can you tell us a little bit about the history of MSCom? Like, how did your guys' organization come to be? How did you grow over the years? Any kind of stories?
Yeah. Back years and years ago now, 1995, I think, was when the first Microsoft.com homepage popped up. And it literally was sitting on a guy's desktop that worked in our team for a number of years, actually still does work in Microsoft.com. The homepage, Microsoft.com, ran under his desk in his office right down not too far from where we sit. So since
that's funny.
Yeah. I mean, so, you know, there's stories of, you know, kicking the power cord and the network cable and things like that. We started off very humbly as a real small deployment and have grown substantially since.
When did you actually upgrade to data centers and start really taking all that stuff seriously?
So I think it was probably about a year after that. I'd say by 1997, for sure, we were in our first data center grown up and proper. By the end of the 1990s, we were off and running, and, you know, maybe didn't have our eye on our key metric, which is availability, which is something that we look at every day. But we were well on our way by that point.
When did you guys start dog fooding a lot of the Microsoft products for the product teams? Was that something that came about in the kind of recently, or is that something that Microsoft's always done with your team?
Well, I'd say originally it wasn't a part of our charter back, you know, again, in that late 90s time period. But somewhere around there, I believe there was a statement that was made by one of our competitors that their website had better availability running on their web platform than Microsoft.com. And you could, you know, it wasn't too difficult for people to go out and see that we weren't always the most reliable and available site at the time. And I believe that was around the 2000 time frame. And as soon as that shot went out, we became very, very focused and serious about deploying only Microsoft products because earlier in our history, it wasn't necessarily all Microsoft technology at the time. Now we run only Microsoft technology. We care about availability. Again, it's our main metric. And with that, since we got so serious about our own web platform, we also started working closely with the product teams to deploy beta versions of our own products so that we could provide real-world, large-scale you know, information back to the product teams on how these products actually worked. And we look at it as an opportunity to really drive a lot of feedback back to the product teams to make the product better for paying customers when it actually hits the market.
Well, I just want to say, I think that's really smart. I really like to hear that you guys are doing that. It's sort of like, look, we'll take the hard punches and figure stuff out because we've got direct insights to people that are using it. You guys are one of the largest sites out there on the internet, so that's a great testing ground for that. When did you actually start going down the path of dog fooding like Server 2008? Because that just recently came out.
Well, I mean, as far as Server 2008, we've really, let me go back a little bit further. I think when I first started on the team, we just released Windows Server 2003. And that's when we'd started that dog food process, you know, basically shortly after Windows 2000 had released. We were running on Windows 2000, but we got in early on the IIS6 Windows Server 2003 product adoption stuff. So we were running builds of Server 2003 well before the betas or anything like that. So once a product launches, we're pretty much already looking at the next version. So shortly after 2003 SP1, where we did our x64 migration and got to the 64-bit platform, we started looking at, of course, Server 2008 builds and stability there, and pretty much that's when we started. We started with a slow adoption, you know, one or two servers, just kind of sneak them in and see if they'll take traffic, that kind of thing, see what the availability and reliability is like, and just keep going from there.
So, guys, we talked a little bit about the value that you guys do with dog fooding the products, but what other value does MSCom provide the whole Microsoft organization and maybe specifically the product teams?
So as far as the value that our operations team provides to the company and the organization, I mean, we are running the publishing systems that are internal. Anybody in Microsoft that wants to put something in the download center or update their web page, or whether it's, you know, you want to find out more information about Windows Server 2008 or, you know, Windows Vista. We run the publishing platform, and we obviously run the production servers that host the content as well. So again, we value availability tremendously, and that's not only of just the end user experience of the homepage, but also the tools that allow our, you know, global corporate Microsoft users to be able to push content out so that they can you know, update information for users. So, you know, that includes all of the Microsoft technologies, you know, updates in the download center, white papers, you name it. You know, there's a lot of value in making sure that that content is available for people to come and consume.
Earlier, I think you guys told us you had, I think you said 80 servers. Is that right?
Well, just until about, I'd say, a month ago, Microsoft.com. So again, when I'm talking about Microsoft.com, I'm talking about the homepage. We were running on 80 physical servers. In the last few weeks, we've been deploying virtual machines on Windows Server 2008. So we're taking advantage of Hyper-V and you know, virtual machines. So now I believe that the number of physical and virtual machines that are currently deployed is 120.
Okay, so let me clarify that. So you keep using the word homepage, like the Microsoft.com homepage. To me, that can mean two things. Like that's one page with, you know, with 80 servers, or that's the Microsoft.com, like www.microsoft.com,
right,
domain.
It's tricky because if you go to Microsoft.com/something, there's a good chance that that's going to be coming off of one of those 80 to 120 servers. There's also a chance that you're going to not.
From an IT engineering perspective, how is www.microsoft.com structured?
So right now we have basically around 600 vroots, 350 plus IIS web applications, and those are distributed amongst 12 different application pools. And all that configuration is duplicated across all of our 80 servers, or what used to be 80 servers, but now nearing 100 with the virtualization project and Hyper-V.
Okay, now those 80 servers, again, when we went back to content delivery, those servers are in different data centers though, right?
Yes, they're spread out over 3 data centers right now for www.
So if one data center went completely down, could you carry the load on the other two?
We're trying to be architected where we could carry the load on one, and we've done that. Up until recently, we were only in 2 data centers. We've added a third recently with the Hyper-V project as well, and we have run on one single data center.
What's the breaking point right now of your setup? I mean, like, what could you get rid of and run on, like, if you had to? Because we're talking about scaling, and it sounds like you guys have got plenty of horsepower, more than what you need. If you've got 3 data centers and you can cut out 2 and you can still run on one, what's your breaking point? What do you really need to run this amount of traffic?
Right now, about, I think we run kind of on an average around 30 to 40% CPU. So if we cut it in half and go from 80 servers to 40, we're going to be pushing around 80% CPU, and that's probably about as hot as we want to run for any extended period of time. So really about half capacity. 40 of the 80 servers are one data center. But we don't want to run that way for too long, because we can run into issues.
Sure.
Cool.
Now, what type of servers are these?
All HP.
Yep. It's primarily all HP. So when we talk about when we are in 2 data centers before with 80 servers, the physical hardware platform that we were running was an HP DL585. So AMD, they were single core machines. They were all 4 ways with 32 gigs of RAM. With the virtualization project, where we've added a third data center, now we're taking advantage of
HP C-class hardware. And so we have a mix of some BL480s and BL680s that we're running on in different configurations. And we're not settled on exactly what the end hardware configuration is going to be at this time.
Hey guys, I've got a question. What's your experience with Hyper-V so far, and what's your take on it? Do you enjoy it? Do you see it adding a lot of value? And do you think a lot of the your enterprise or Microsoft Enterprise partners and clients will see a lot of value from it in the future?
Yes. So it's interesting. I mean, the virtualization story that as we see it right now is going to play out different depending on what you're trying to do, which is kind of obvious. But on Microsoft.com, so where we see the opportunity isn't probably as much as in the performance gain that we'll be able to get by consolidating multiple images on a single physical machine. Because right now we're such a consolidated environment that two guests per a single host probably would be about what we're comfortable with. But what the real benefit is going to be is that, again, it's a very complex hosted environment with many, many different applications and different app pools. Right now, one of our challenges is being able to provide a replica of a production environment back to a test team or a development team. And using virtualization, that problem becomes very, very easy to solve. We just snap off an image of production, and we can build out replicas of an identical production machine very quickly. And so we have a really strong focus on creating a dynamic IT environment. For some of the other properties that are not on Microsoft.com, the opportunity really is we're able to consolidate our physical footprint of servers. So we can consolidate on one larger physical box and create and run many virtual machines. So it depends on which problem you're trying to solve. If you're trying to consolidate, get more bang for your buck, there's that opportunity exists, and we are taking advantage of that with Hyper-V right now on MSDN and TechNet. And then for Microsoft.com, we're taking advantage of Hyper-V in the fact that we're going to be able to create a dynamic IT environment where we can build new machines and snap off images for dev and test very quickly.
Okay, so for those listeners out there that aren't familiar with Hyper-V, and I have to be honest, I know what Hyper-V is. I've seen a lot of stuff, but I haven't used it. So can you give us a quick overview, just kind of break it back down a little bit for us, and just kind of give us an overview as to what Hyper-V is and what features that it provides?
Well, I'll try. I'm not a Hyper-V marketing guy, but...
Good. That's not what we want.
Hyper-V basically shipped with Windows Server 2008. It allows you to run virtual instances of the operating system. So we can basically... abstract the operating system from the hardware and have it run on in a virtual instance where we can make it more portable, transportable, and you have virtual hardware and virtual interfaces to the hardware. So, like I said, given the right hardware, you can run several instances of Windows Server 2008 or even some of the down level server operating systems. In a virtualized environment. We haven't noticed, reliability-wise, we haven't had any issues. Reliability-wise, the performance hit has been minimal. With the combination of the newer hardware and Hyper-V, we really haven't taken any hit in our availability, and performance hasn't really suffered at all either. So
right now, the story sounds pretty good. It sounds like you guys are really dog-fooding that then.
I think we've kind of moved beyond dog fooding it. We're really moving forward with that's going to be our platform in production in the future.
So you're cat fooding it? Would that be past dog fooding?
We're deploying it.
Yeah, our goal will be to be running fully virtualized here in the next few months.
Sounds like you guys are like ripping stuff. It's like, hey, there's this new thing. Okay, let's throw out what we got and put that in so we can, you know, test that. We got this new thing coming out. Let's, I mean, you're like moving stuff around a lot, it seems, guys.
Well, I mean, we are serious about dog fooding, about being aggressive. But we also do have a responsibility to our budgets. And, you know, people think that because we're Microsoft, of course, we must have, you know, the big checkbook doesn't have any limits, and that isn't true. Every year we actually are asked to do a little bit more with a little bit less, just like probably many, many folks are. And so we, aren't throwing things out for the sake of throwing them out, but we are looking at ways to optimize our environment, save money, and make sure that we don't jeopardize our availability. So it just so happens that virtualization is, we see enough benefit for this that we've invested in it, and that's why we're going with it. And the fact of the matter is that with all the changes that we've done to Microsoft.com over the year and all the dog fooding that we've done, our availability year to year has been going up. And so we're really proud of the fact that we're able to, you know, change things around, run new platforms that the company is developing while not jeopardizing our availability.
That's a very good story. I like
that.
Yeah,
it is. Yeah, it's really good that you guys are kind of leading the charge and being a good example for people out there for virtualization. But I've got a question. Have you found something that you guys do that cannot be virtualized, or you guys don't virtualize something because maybe a product team doesn't recommend it?
Yeah, I think right now as far as things that we wouldn't virtualize, I think we're looking at, right now, it's still new to us in the fact that, I mean, we've been keeping an eye on what we know we wanted to virtualize, and now there's kind of the rest of everything that we're saying, hey, you know, could we virtualize that, or is that a bad idea? And so right now we have some questions on whether we are going to virtualize some of our SQL servers or not. I wouldn't say that there aren't SQL servers that we absolutely would say never, but I think we have more questions than answers about how we have our servers deployed in our environment. I think also maybe some of our download servers, we've had some questions whether there would be a lot of value in creating a virtual image of basically just a large file server with, you know, terabytes of files. And so I think right now I would say that we haven't ruled everything out, but there are just some places where that we're still evaluating it. I think anything that requires a large amount of memory is probably something that
a large amount of memory and a large number of processors, I think, you know. So some of the bigger SQL servers we have, you know, I guess the other thing is network bandwidth, like the download servers. Those are just, you know, huge file servers with lots of static files. Doesn't really make a lot of sense for us to virtualize those yet, but it's something we'll look at further down the road.
Brad, you mentioned SQL Server there. How many database servers do you guys have, and what can you tell us about those database servers?
So as far as database servers, I think specifically for, again, when Jim was talking about how many applications and vRoots are running off of Microsoft.com, specifically for that, you're looking at about 15 SQL servers in total. So that includes, primary servers and warm standby servers. And so, again, we're already dogfooding SQL Server 2008 and taking advantage of some of the new features that are going to be coming out with that product line. We have the luxury of, because some of the database-driven sites that we run are, from a database perspective, static. So somebody here, Microsoft corporate user, publishes information into their system, and then it's consumed dynamically by end users, but the data is to the end user is static. We can actually distribute multiple copies of that read-only database to multiple data centers and do some fun things there as well. So from a SQL Server standpoint, We don't necessarily have the biggest SQL servers in the world, but we do have many databases, and we try to scale them out as much as possible.
So out of those 80 servers, 15 of them are database servers?
No, the 15 servers are completely separate from that. And so when we talk about the 80 servers or the 100 to 120 plus, whatever, we're adopting virtualization, that 80 to somewhere 100 plus servers, those are only web servers. So that's just IIS.
That's your front end servers then. What type of software do you guys use to make this scaling possible? Do you guys have some custom in-house stuff? For example, do you guys use a distributed file system that's baked into Windows, or do you use something else? And there's a new product talking about dog fooding that came out recently called Velocity, which allows servers to share memory and sessions and stuff like that.
Well, we have a lot of in-house tools, and we leverage a lot of the Windows features as well. We do leverage DFSR for file system replication for some of our content. We've also, with the .NET framework, we're able to develop our own in-house tools rather quickly as well to, fill in some of the gaps that we have as well. So we are looking at Velocity. I know some of the other development teams have come out with kind of a similar technology for problems that they were trying to resolve, but it was all developed with the .NET framework stuff.
So, I mean, it really doesn't sound like you guys are using anything besides what's out of the product then, really. I mean, you got DFS, and Velocity is something that's going to be produced that's coming down the road. I mean, there is really nothing that you guys use other besides you either wrote it or it's baked into the product.
Yeah, I mean, again, we're really proud of the fact that using Microsoft technologies in the way that our customers are going to be able to use it as well. So the one thing that place where I'd say that we have a non-Microsoft technology dependency really is in our hardware load balancing, which we're using Citrix NetScalers, to use some of our data center load balancing. Historically, we've been using Windows load balancing, which again we are showcasing our own technologies with through Windows Server 2003. With Windows Server 2008, that's when we decided to make the jump to a hardware load balancer, just because it offered some additional capabilities that we were looking for. But other than that, we are a Microsoft shop. We really have not developed and deployed anything that is proprietary to us, that we have a secret sauce, per se, that somebody else couldn't have.
I guess I'm asking that question because, I mean, to me, it's like a mystery. I mean, you guys have such a large amount of data you're pushing, and you're doing things with it that, I mean, really, I mean, you are like a major, enterprise setup deployment. I work in the enterprise, and we do, we have a whole mixture of a lot of things, and it's just kind of interesting to hear that you guys are we're just using server, and we put hardware load balancers or stuff in front of it, which is pretty standard in the industry. That's nothing new, what about in terms of bottlenecks? What's your biggest bottleneck?
So I think both Jim and I will probably have things to add to this. So I'll start. I'd say that one of the bottlenecks that I'm aware of that we're always trying to figure out a good way to work around is really starting at the back end, and it's the database. It's for those applications that are, have user interaction. So a user comes to a site on Microsoft.com, they enter information that gets put in a database that they can see right away again. So think of a site like a forum, where you post into the forum, and how do you have a database repository that scales multiple data centers real time? That's one of the biggest bottlenecks in those types of systems that, again, we're trying to do things on a budget. So it's not like we can just go out and buy the latest and greatest, multi-million-dollar solution to solve that problem. We are looking at ways that we can use Microsoft technologies and create scalable and, I don't want to say low cost, but reasonably priced solutions that span multiple data centers. So the database in some applications is definitely a bottleneck.
As far as the web front end, taking like www, for instance, our bottleneck there is, you know, definitely the amount of RAM we have in the servers, just because of the number of applications that we have defined, and then also our disk I/O, because the content is constantly changing. People can publish content pretty much 24/7. So as new content gets published out, we have to sometimes take a dynamic compilation hit as ASPX pages and stuff like that need to get recompiled dynamically. So our disk I/O is definitely, you know, one of our bottlenecks that we keep an eye on, and also, you know, just physical RAM, because we're adding new applications all the time. Everybody's, you know, there's always somebody new coming to us saying they need a new application out on www. So that's one of the reasons we went to the 64-bit, because we were definitely hitting the memory limits of 32-bit OS.
Do you guys, I mean, we've seen in the past maybe month, there's a lot of sites that are going down from DDoS attacks and hackers out there. I mean, one big one was a big online retailer, I won't say the name, went down for like half a day. I assume that's a big, kind of a big job for you guys to kind of see vulnerabilities, keep up with that. Two questions. How do you guys stop hacker attacks and DDoS attacks? And two, how do you guys kind of preempt a lot of those attacks and kind of harden your networks?
Well, we use, on the front end, we use basically Cisco guard devices for packet filtering. Of course, all of our stuff is locked down as far as, what ports are open, that kind of thing. But we use basically Cisco guard devices that do packet filtering and anomaly tracking. And, you know, that's been our number one protection for the last couple of years, I think. Prior to that, though, we were just, NLB Windows on the Internet, and we were getting attacked pretty much on a constant basis. So even during some of those times, we were able to stay up and alive on the Internet with NLB. But we've since moved to hardware guard devices.
Yeah. So one other thing to add about the DOS attacks is that prior to having the Cisco guards in place, we were mostly reacting. And so what would happen is somebody would attack us, we would suffer an availability hit, and so our tier one is monitoring our availability nonstop, and 7x24, and we'd react to it, and we'd go out and we'd respond. So with the Cisco guards, we actually have been under attack. I can't remember what the variant is that's out there, but we've been under attack by something that's been deployed that's just running on people's machines. Probably they don't even know it. Now for about 2 years, I believe it is. And we just filter the packets and throw them out. And so since we've started using, this is, besides the NetScalers, this is the complete architecture of Microsoft.com now. So we do packet filtering with Cisco guards. We do network load balancing with Citrix NetScalers. And below that, it's just Windows Server 2008 and SQL Server 2008 or 2005 and 2008 in some systems now.
Yeah, I mean, you guys, obviously, you're a big company and a lot of people like to target you. So, I mean, I would imagine that's something that you're going to always have to deal with. I mean, having something running for 2 years and attacking you, it just is sort of like, we know it's there, throw it away.
Yeah, well, I think the thing that surprises people the most when we talk to them about our architecture is that we're not running any firewalls. And so when Jim said we had ports locked down, we only lock every port down except for 80 and 443. and we're not using a firewall.
Huh. Now that I didn't ask. So that packet sniffer device, I forget it's a Cisco one. That's not a firewall. That's just sniffing packets,
exactly.
Sort of. Okay. I thought that was doing firewalling too and stuff. But I mean, really, if the machines only have 80 and 443, there's really nothing else to firewall, right?
Right. Yeah. Basically, at the router, at the edge router layers, that's where we only have port 80 and 443 open. So, but the servers are, you know, just plain Windows Server 2008.
Okay, so with all those servers and all of those different data centers, I've got to ask this question, being a software developer. How in the world does somebody like the Goo or somebody else push something out to www.microsoft.com for it to be viewed or downloaded, or like there's a new application? What is that process? How do you guys deal with that?
So you're really asking about our publishing process. You know, if somebody wants to update something.
I mean, it can't be simple. It's not just a simple, hey, FTP this file to the server. I mean, you got a whole bunch of servers, you got different data centers, you've got content delivery networks to think about.
Yeah, and really, you know, we have a number of different internal publishing tools. Again, these are our interfaces that we've developed in-house, you know, depending on the specific need. But if we take a download, for example, there is a publishing tool where a person goes in and submits the files to be downloaded. They submit a description of the file. It goes through a process of ensuring that you know, what is going out there is complies with Microsoft policies. And really, once they have jumped over the hoops in the process of just making sure that they're compliant, they push the button and they don't have to worry about anything after that point. What happens next is that the system picks up those files. It gets deployed out to our Microsoft.com downloads origin servers, and that file will then get pushed out to our content delivery networks and get cached globally. And so, really, from I'm sure if you talk to somebody in the company that actually has to put out a download, they would tell you that the process of making sure they're compliant is the biggest challenge in publishing a download out into the download center. In terms of just content on web pages, again, there's a publishing tool that's built for, you know, deploying changes to your site. And once you're set up to have as a site owner and you know, have access to the tool, you can change the site as frequently and as often as you want, depending on the types of files you're putting out there, and that happens 24/7. And so, again, there's a little bit of latency from the time that you click submit to get the content out to all 80 servers, but it's probably our processes that is the biggest bottleneck as far as somebody getting out.
Well, I think that makes sense. I mean, somebody, you got to go through, you know, make sure legal stuff is there and, you know, the marketing and the all of that stuff. But once somebody, I mean, so if somebody wanted to fix a typo on a web page, I mean, literally they would just go in, edit it, and then they would go into your tool and click a button, and then it would just get pushed out because they've already done all that hard work.
That's it. It's done.
So it's just a mess. It's sort of like what we do. I mean, we have, you know, push mechanisms, but I don't know if, like, if once a content owner becomes a content owner, then they can just do stuff. What about like developers? Do you allow developers to do that? Or is there something in the middle? Like if I need to fix a bug, I can fix the bug, check it into source control, and then push the button and push it. I mean, or is there more process in there?
Well, it's, it kind of varies. We have a lot of different levels there. We have, some internal MSCOM developer groups, and they're a lot more controlled with their versioning control and their releases of their applications. They go through a whole release process, that kind of thing. But we also have, you know, the international subsidiaries out there that can publish content, and, you know, some of their applications are just raw CS files, you know, C# files that they just publish out to the website. They get dynamically compiled, and you know, basically they're running that way. So we have really a mix of a little bit of everything, you know, from very controlled releases to, you know, very uncontrolled releases.
That's kind of a different story. I thought it would be like we're very controlled, you know.
Yeah, I would have thought that too.
It depends. You know, like I said, the international subsidiaries, you know, they're different time zones from Redmond. They want to have a control over their own content and their applications, and a lot of it's maybe vendor coded, so they just, you know, replicate the files out there and they're up and going. So, but for the main applications, you know, like the Windows sites, the homepage, those are a lot more controlled as far as releases go.
Okay.
So, hey guys, what's the biggest, maybe the weirdest bug that stumped you guys for the longest amount of time that you guys, after you kind of fixed it, you scratched your head and said, how the heck did that ever get into the system?
Ooh, that's a tough one. I've been here for 5 years, and there's been a lot of different bugs from early product adoption stuff. You know, bugs with the product that we caught before it's been released to, you know, just our own application developers, you know, writing the content, having their own bugs that they create and publish out there. I don't know. I can't think of any one that really sticks out there. I mean, there's been a lot.
Oh, I bet. I mean, dog fooding everything, you guys probably run a lot of stuff, but was there anything that you guys just, that maybe you look at now and just have a good laugh, or at the time when you fixed it, you said, okay, now it's time to go out and have a
yes.
beer?
There was one that I was involved with where we actually did go out and have a beer afterwards. So we had an application that originally wasn't developed within the Microsoft.com development teams, but it was through a reorg in Microsoft, which were notorious for having, you know, a lot of organizational changes. We had an application come in that we were supporting, and coincidentally at the time, the application also started to experience, it had gone from being a really small app to a very large app. And all of a sudden, the performance just tanked, and the site was timing out, and so we had a number of senior resources looking at it, trying to figure out what in the world was going on. You know, was it the volume of traffic that, you know, we just couldn't keep up with this new traffic, or was it a problem with the code? And in this case, it actually had a database in the back end, and we spent probably three days almost nonstop trying to track down and troubleshooting this application. And what it turned out to be was one line of SQL code in one procedure that the way it was developed, it was expected to return one row. And instead, it did return one row, but it evaluated every row and every table. And so not just as simple as saying, well, oh, you wrote a bad query, it did a table scan. It was the syntax of the query that, you know, when you looked at it at face value, you would expect that it wouldn't do a table scan, it actually did. So it was a bug in the T-SQL code. And there were probably about, you know, again, 3 to 5 different people constantly looking at it. And it wasn't until we had... we reached out for a little bit more help, and somebody walked in with a fresh set of eyes and looked at it and said, well, gosh, that doesn't look right, and identified the problem within about 10 minutes of looking at it. And we had a beer and had a good chuckle after it was done, but there's a lot of tired eyes during that period.
Yeah, that's what I was looking for. I mean, back up for you guys. I like your statement when you said this application was meant to be and started small and then just went huge. I mean, I don't think anyone out in the development community would even know anything about that. So I would.
He said with a sarcastic tone.
And yeah. The funny thing was, yeah. The application had been deployed for at least 1 year at that point, and it had always run fine. And so it's just that they had reached that breaking point where now the back end couldn't keep up with, you know, doing these table scans with the volume of data that was in there. So it was just wacky. And actually, in the end, it was really simple. But at the time, it was a bugger to look at.
And I can imagine people like going, who pushed the code? Who changed something? Go back in source control. Who changed the thing? Somebody pushed something because they've been working for so long.
We were convinced it was the hardware. We moved it onto hardware. I think it was right around the time that 64-bit had just come out. And so it's like, well, maybe it's the 64-bit hardware. You know, what's going on? Because Lord knows nobody's changed any of this code. Well, in fact, it was the code. They'd had a bug the whole time.
Right. Just never know. I mean, I've written a lot of those myself, so I can't cast the first stone by any means.
Oh, no. No one can.
So here's my question, guys. Woody and I are developers, but if you were going to sit down with some, you know, IT engineers that are out in corporate America, you know, the guy setting up Windows Server 2008 at the fire department in Kansas or somewhere, what are some tips and tricks that you could share with everybody in, you know, things that you've learned over time? So what are some things about, you know, SQL Server tips, 2008 setups, load balancing, IIS? We can just kind of cover anything you want to cover.
Oh, tips and tricks. I guess on the front end web server, it's all, you know, everything we do is ASP.NET. So kind of baseline your applications and know what your performance footprint is, your memory footprint, your performance, you know, requests per second, stuff like that. We've run 12 application pools. Definitely take advantage of the features of IIS and break stuff, applications into their own app pools, if that makes sense.
Is there a point to where, like, you can create too many application pools?
Yeah, you got to keep your eye on physical RAM, right? Because you'll have more processes than your RAM can support, so you'll start hitting the page file. Just basically our focus is mainly around performance. You know, there's a few, you know, well-known coding things with .NET, you know, that are known to cause, performance issues. You know, use string builders when you can, avoid string concat type stuff. You know, don't call GC collect in applications. You know, there's a lot of ways to optimize .NET code to behave better with the GC. Our developers are aware of all that stuff.
Do you guys focus the developers a lot on pre-optimization of their code? Or, I mean, how strict are you? Like, if somebody didn't use a string builder and they wrote a concatenation, you know, with the concatenation operator, would your tools catch that before it got out in production? Or would it get out there, then you would see a decrease in performance and then you'd do something about it?
Typically, it's just going to be a manual set of eyes looking at it. We don't have any automated tool for that. We have a code review tool. I can't remember the name. What's the Visual Studio's?
FX Cop?
Yeah, the FX Cop. We had some FX Cop rules that we wrote, and we kind of distributed that to some of the to our dev groups, and actually one of our dev test teams picked it up and kind of polished it a little bit better, and they used that before they released their code, so that catches the glaring issues. But like I said, with some of the ICPs or international subs that we don't have as much control over, they can just publish content out all the time, so sometimes we won't. It's just reactive. We'll notice some kind of a performance issue, and then we'll have to investigate and figure out what's going on.
Okay, so that's IIS and ASP.NET. Any Server 2008 SQL Server tips?
Not specifically the SQL Server 2008 at this point. I mean, I think most of the tips that the things that I've seen that usually cause us problems with SQL servers, typically around performance, and it comes from either. I think indexes are often the root of the problem, and something that was developed with a small set of data, or an application that started off with a small set of data, where it seemed like everything was tuned just right. As your database grows and you get more use, just because you've deployed indexes doesn't mean that you necessarily have the right indexes. So take a look at those and make sure that your DBA is actually maintaining those indexes as well. That usually in performance problems is where we start go diving in immediately. It's just what's the indexing strategy? Are they relevant and are they up to date?
Velocity looks interesting. We like I said, our development groups are looking at that internally. The website developers are looking at that internally, but we haven't really deployed anything with that yet. But Velocity looks like an interesting technology and something that could solve some more of our scalability issues, or help in that regard.
Well, I know you guys have a lot of information out there on the website. You've got things out on TechNet. You've got things out on your blogs. You're putting a lot of information out there for people. So if they have any more questions or want to find out more about the Microsoft.com operations, they can find you at where, Brad or Jim?
People can find more information at technet.microsoft.com. And then go to the Tech Centers tab, and there's a Microsoft.com operations tech center.
Very good. Well, we certainly appreciate your time today, guys. We really appreciate you taking some time out of your busy schedules. We know you've got a lot of stuff to do, and we'd like to thank you for coming on this show again. Woody, it was a pleasure, sir, talking to you again.
Thank you, and I really want to appreciate the guys coming on. I learned a lot tonight.
He has a lot of good information. I'm really surprised you guys are pushing that much stuff through there. How much was it? You said it was like up to 5 gigabit a second or something
gigabits.
Like that? It's crazy. 500? 500 gigabits a second? Wow, I missed that.
High watermark.
That's nuts, guys. Well, I really do appreciate it again. We hope you'll come back and talk to us down the road whenever you are starting to dog food some new stuff. And we can talk about some of the challenges and some of the things that you overcome in doing that. So, folks, until next time, keep your tea glasses full and your axes sharp. We'll see you.
See you, guys.